Our last seminar of the morning, Technosphere / Coevolution. This will be presented by Jürgen Renn and Manfred Laubichler. Jürgen Renn is the director of the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science here in Berlin. He's been the director since 1994, so 20 years. He works on structural changes in knowledge systems, and he is a major proponent of open access to knowledge, having been part of the Berlin Declaration on Open Access and a book series that uses that frame. Manfred Laubichler is the President's Professor of Theoretical Biology and History of Biology at Arizona State University. His background is amazing. He is a biologist, zoologist, philosopher, and historian of science. He was trained at Vienna, at Yale, and at Princeton. And his research goes from all the way from theoretical and evolutionary biology to complexity theory, the cultural history of science, and the digital humanities. So please welcome them.
So before we start, some introductory remark. Thank you for the very friendly and generous introduction. This was, as you may remember, initially intended for each of the seminars to be a triad. Actually, it has become, in our case, a pentagon. A pentagon about which I will say a few words. And because you see just the two of us standing here, it has been the case that for personal reasons, Armin Reller has been prevented from participating in the early phase. He will join us next week for the seminar. The contrary is true for Jan Zalazievic, who has played a pivotal, very important role in the preparation of this seminar. You know, a leading geological thinker of the Anthropocene. He, unfortunately, also for personal reasons, is prevented from coming next week. But if you have read some of the papers that we have put on the server, many of them are by himself or have been influenced by his work. So he is still a very important figure for the seminar. So as he was prevented from coming, the idea came up. And if you read those papers, you see much reference is being made to the concept of technosphere, which has originated in the work of Peter Huff. Now, it's incredible, and we are very happy about this, that the organizers have been able to convince Peter Huff on very short notice, and he will come actually this weekend and join the seminar. And so we will have occasion to discuss together with him the concept of the technosphere. Two other preliminary remarks. You can see from the earlier presentations of seminars today that there is a need for rethinking some of the fundamental concepts in which we think the Anthropocene. And I think our seminar is closely related to that in a different way. You have seen reflections on issues such as ontology or accounting systems of the Anthropocene. We take a different angle, but before I go a little bit into that angle that we are taking, I want to say that we are, of course, really standing on the shoulders of giants and you know, learning from Sabine Höhler that will be a little bit of a commercial break now, because I want to point your attention, this is not for auction, but it is for sale. And these are the three volumes of a book on the Anthropocene that has been produced in the context of the Anthropocene project here at the HKW. It's not my book, and this is why I take the liberty of advertising it to you. It's also not yet available in the US because this is with MIT Press and they will launch it only next year. It's called Grain, Vapor, Ray, Textures of the Anthropocene. It has been edited by Katrin Klingan and her co-editors. It's a marvelous book, I think. You find many ideas, stimulating reflections about rethinking the Anthropocene. This is why I'm mentioning it here. And you can have it for just 39 euros, the entire set. So it's a little bit more expensive than the natural resources, but you know, I think it's worthwhile. So now let me go into the subject of the seminar. As I already said, we are also engaged in conceptual rethinking, And we are particularly interested in the dynamics of the Anthropocene. To be more precise, we are interested in the long-term evolutionary dynamics of planetary environments shaped by biological and human actors. As you know, there is currently a lot of discussion on the concept of the Anthropocene from a geological point of view. Is this really a new geological period, epoch? Does it meet the standards? Does it meet the criteria? Now, much of this is has a taxonomic, a classificatory, a descriptive dimension. We are more interested in the actors category, in the causality of the Anthropocene. You know the discussions also about when the Anthropocene started. Is it, you know, as you could see from some of the slides you have just seen, is it in the 60s, in the 50s, in the 60s? Is it with the Industrial Revolution, or is it even with the Neolithic Revolution, about which we'll be talking in a moment? Much of this discussion hinges on these taxonomic descriptive criteria. We are more interested in the onset of a certain dynamics. Which are the internal and external conditions of actors that shape this evolutionary dynamics, eventually leading up to the Anthropocene and to the technosphere? Can we distinguish major phases, a cascade perhaps of phases, one leading into the other, and how are these phases causally connected to each other? Now, you can already see from these introductory remarks also about the persons involved that we are confronting two major perspectives which may well turn out to be complementary, but as they are different perspectives, we thought to structure the seminar also around their difference, their perhaps complementarity, but at least around their contrast. One is the proposal made by Peter Haff and taken up by Jan Salasiewicz in terms of the technosphere, stressing the significance of the human deposits, geological deposits, but also the autonomy of the technosphere. You know, this is a concept that's standing in a long intellectual tradition. Vernadsky and others, there are various spheres that have been proposed, but the stress here is clearly here on the autonomy with regard to the human actors. Whereas Manfred and myself, we have been for some time now been involved in trying to develop a perspective that you might consider as cultural evolutionary or cultural biological co-evolutionary, that stresses more the human actors' perspective. So what we want to do in the seminar, and this will be one of the main tasks, is to confront those two perspectives, the one focusing on this technosphere geological approach and the other focusing on the co-evolutionary approach. This is why the seminar also has this double name. And to confront these perspectives, explore them, and see to which extent they are conflicting or complementary. So this is also a challenge to the participants. And therefore, we have asked the participants to read some of the available papers and to develop their own views, and they will work in groups and then confront the perspectives together. And another task for the seminar, a task for ourselves, as a matter of fact, is to outline the big history picture of the Anthropocene, to distinguish some of the evolutionary phases, the main evolutionary phases that have shaped, possibly shaped, the Anthropocene, and to compare now, notes at the end, to compare the two epistemological perspectives, if you want, with this more narrative account of the evolution, the large-scale evolution of the Anthropocene. So I think I have hoped to have given you a structural outline of how we want to proceed. And I now hand the word to Manfred, who will indicate you some of the more concrete steps that we have been contemplating, not to anticipate any of your work, but just to stimulate a little bit the way that we have been thinking.
Yeah, thanks, Jürgen. I was actually very glad that Bronislav had the slide up there that showed the deep history of the planet all the way to the present, because this is actually one of the main themes that we have in mind when we explore the history of the Anthropocene. Where does it start? And the geological approach seems to look at distinct periods and try to figure out differences between them and characteristic phases. An evolutionary approach looks deeper and looks at the dynamics. And in that sense, one of the major themes that we will be pursuing in that seminar can be sort of summarized by the phrase, the presence of the past. And how deep do we actually have to go to see mechanisms and processes in place that actually shape the dynamics that we explore now in the context of the Anthropocene? Well, let's start way in the distant past. The formation of our solar system certainly is relevant. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here on this particular planet. But one interesting point about that history, and Jan actually wrote a book on this, is the concept of the Goldilocks zone. So if we now search for exoplanets that might actually have life on them, we realize that a planet that actually can carry life has to be in a very unique zone, the right distance from the sun, so that you can actually have liquid water and several other conditions. So it's a very unique zone that our planet is in, and that's sort of a concept called the Goldilocks zone. Now, once you have a planet like that, and we obviously have an N of one that we know about, even though there are some tantalizing observations quite recently that we might actually have identified some other candidates. So once you have such a planet, it becomes an interesting question. Is life predictable? And the answer pretty much is yes. Given those conditions, then life, as we define it as a certain self-replicating system, is more or less predictable, given what we know about the basic conceptions of thermodynamics and natural selective processes. So what you then are faced is the onset of an interaction between what we would call an evolutionary dynamics and the notion of complex systems. And complexity is one of the main themes, one of the nine themes that we will come back at the end of the whole campus. So let me introduce it here in that context. What actually happens once systems reach a significant degree of complexity that you recognize them as life, and what follows from that? What follows from that in sort of a grand historical narrative is that we observe variation, of course, but we also see major transitions in those evolutionary events. Now, major transition is something interesting because, you know, quantitatively something interesting happens in a major transition. Is it always good what happens in a major transition? Well, that depends on your perspective. Certainly, the first form of anaerobic life, if they would reflect back, would thought that the evolutionary innovation of photosynthesis and oxygen is a very bad idea, because it basically wiped out more or less all of those earlier life forms. They still do exist in some extreme environments. But that already shows that what another feature of those historical dynamics leading up to the Anthropocene has something to do with poison and opportunity. Oxygen is the prime example for that. Obviously, without oxygen, we wouldn't be here. Most forms of life that we know, it wouldn't be here. Life would be here. So it was a poison for one, an opportunity for the other. So that's an interesting challenge. What other features do those major transitions have? Well, one of the early on ones was the evolutionary emergence of eukaryotes, sort of the real cells, the ones that have a cellular nucleus. The mechanism here is interesting because it's also one that is very much in the presence in many ways in the Anthropocene. It was symbiosis. As you might know, that the mitochondria, sort of the power plants of our cells, are basically symbiotic prokaryotes, sort of symbiotic bacteria within a eukaryotic cell. So major merging of evolutionary lineages in those transitions. Once you have multicellular life, we see interesting trends again. We see the evolution of major body plants, and that's very interesting. A body plan, for the non-biologists here, so basically most of you, is a major organizational principle of animal or plant form. The interesting thing is we have hundreds of millions of species that we know about on that planet, either existing or having existed, yet in terms of animals, they fall into less than 50 major body plans. Why? Why this increased conservation of forms? Why it's not more explored? There are reasons for that. And what are the consequences of body plan evolution, and how do we get those body plans? And why is it so difficult to change them or get a new one? Basically, there hasn't been a new body plan in several hundreds of millions of years. Again, why? So we talk a lot about innovation in the context of the Anthropocene. And in many of the more technological approaches to the Anthropocene, it's all a consequence, it's either a consequence of our innovative capacity as a technological species, or innovation is our only salvation. So there's an interesting tension. On the one hand, the problems of the Anthropocene are the consequences of centuries of unchecked innovations, yet somehow we believe that our only way out is through even more innovation. That is a certain predicament that we might want to explore as well. But innovation has to be looked at critically, because if you look at innovation from the point of view of the history of life, one of the interesting features is the suppression of innovation. What mechanisms actually suppress innovation? And this is also one that plays an important role in the context of the Anthropocene. Now, another part of the evolutionary history is how do we actually generate something new, whether it's an innovation or just a variation, is through mechanisms such as tinkering and toolkit. And for that, since we're also exploring not just traditional ways of representing that history, but some more creative ways, we want to show you a brief clip from a very creative approach by a colleague and friend, Neil Shubin, in his book, Our Inner Fish. It's basically a book that introduces you to the presence of the past. So if I can have that clip, please. It's about 2.5, 3 minutes.
Studying the DNA of ancient organisms is a window into our distant past. And if you look hard enough, you can find some creatures today that haven't changed much in hundreds of millions of years. This coast is home to a relative that shows us how ancient the genetic recipe is for building our brain.
Yeah, how do you know where to look?
Well, except you want to go deeper than this.
Meet Peter Holland, head of zoology at Oxford University in England.
Right, okay. Well, we could start trying around
X
here.
X marks the spot?
X marks the spot. Let's give it a go. Okay.
So that's basically biologists at work.
Okay, so what do I do?
Just shake it. Shake. You got one. There's an amphioxus.
We got any? Whoa, look at that little guy go. Hey!
Just dip it in the water again, you'll see it. It'll flick around.
Well, they really flick.
There you see. There he is.
Hey, that's beautiful. Look at that. Which is the front?
It doesn't look like much, but this tiny creature called amphioxus has much to tell us about our own brains.
That is cool. Oh. Okay, that ranks as cool.
Okay, so let's take a look at a couple of these.
So I brought this from the anatomy lab in Chicago. This is a human brain. And when I look at this, I don't find any obvious similarities to that.
Deep in the genes of this animal and the development of this animal, and deep in the genes of us and the development of us, there are the similarities.
So if you just take a look at that.
He's just moved.
Oh, he twitched
away.
Yeah,
they're
pretty active.
Holy cow. Oh, that is beautiful. God, they're so clear too, you can see right through them. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
Amphioxus lives in the sand of the ocean floor, filtering algae out of the water. They have a simple nerve cord that runs the length of the body, which ends with a tiny swelling invisible to the naked eye.
If you look at the front end of this animal, you don't see it all expanded into a large skull or brain region. It's just pointed.
We might not have similar brains, but what we do have are similar genes. To make the forebrain, midbrain, and hindbrain, you need a series of control genes to tell the cells within the developing brain where they are. They map out the brain's three basic regions. Versions of the same master genes that help form our own brains are also active in Amphioxus. But here, they're simply building the primitive nerve cord and the tiny swelling at its front. This means that the genetic roots of our own brains can be seen in creatures that first arose over 500 million years ago.
You can stop that now. Okay, so this is just a way how we can actually get at the presence of the past in the context of the grand evolutionary narrative leading up to the Anthropocene. Because clearly, once we get our brains, then we get into the questions of the social evolution, the technosphere, and the Anthropocene as we know it here. And I think in that context, we then can also raise the question, what are the future possible trajectories from our current point of view? So this is a brief sketch of the grand narrative that we want to explore in the context of our seminar. But as Jürgen pointed out, the main focus of this is not just to create a chronology, but to also emphasize what are the mechanisms, what are the processes that actually have shaped that dynamic, and how can we understand those. And so in order to give you a brief taste of how we want to do that, let's talk a little bit about one of the episodes in that history in a little more detail, and that's the Neolithic Revolution. So Jürgen, do you want to get us started on that?
Yeah. So the Neolithic Revolution, as I mentioned earlier, has been proposed as a starting point for the Anthropocene. There is a recent paper by Smith and Melinda Zeder in which this proposal was made, because this is the onset of a dynamics of human-caused changes of the environment that has propagated basically on a global level starting from the Neolithic. Now, what is the explanation, however, for this dynamic? We all know that the Neolithic started in environmentally favorable conditions at the beginning of the Holocene, and that humans used resources that were available to them under those favorable conditions, domesticable plants and animals. But that really doesn't explain how this momentary favorable conditions actually transformed into structural changes. Now, people have tried to apply to such structural changes the logic of conventional evolutionary theory, trying to carry it over to cultural evolution, trying to find analogs to the biological mechanisms of the creation of variations and to selection mechanisms. And clearly, you have basic analogs between biological systems and cultural systems, such as hereditability and, of course, also selection processes. But it did turn out that it is a bit hard to actually follow this logic through to the end. And when Manfred and I started to discuss this, we found one, and we were not the first to find this, one additional element that in any case needs to be taken into account, that is what the modern evolutionary biologists call niche construction. Now, that's an interesting concept. It's a deeply Darwinian concept, of course, because it was known for a long term that not just humans, but many species do change their environment by constructing the environment. Think of beavers building dams, or many of the social insects building their nests. So, and this gives rise to what biologists have called reciprocal causality. That is, the selective forces of the environment are not just produced by the physical environment and not just by the other species living in a niche, but they are also shaped by the species itself that transforms the environment. Now, we have thought that this is a very interesting way to connect biological to cultural evolution, because humans are, of course, very visible niche constructors. The technosphere can be considered as a human constructed niche in that sense. But we have found difficulties in seeing the role of the niche just in the selective dynamics. I think this carries the analogy between biological and cultural evolution a bit far, because then you would always have, many variations, many different phenotypes, and then you would have to explain really what the selective forces are. In cultural evolution, this is not a life and death issues. You know, some have proposed memory plays a big role here. But we thought this really underestimates the role of the niches in the cultural domain. Clearly, those niches don't have just a selective role in this dynamics, they have a regulative dynamics. And this is where the idea between Manfred and myself came up, that maybe we should combine what Manfred has just indicated here about these complex genomic networks and the role that they play in biological evolution with the idea of the niches, and think of niches not just in their selective function, but think of them in terms of their regulative function. So niches can be considered to some extent also as external parts of the organism or external parts of the regulative systems of which the organism is part. And if I now come back to the issue of the Neolithic Revolution, you will see that this gives an indication of why this may help to answer some of the fundamental questions about Neolithic Revolution and make it clear why this has been not just an occasional, a one-time, a singular event, but how this came to change the history of humanity on eventually a global scale. Because the environmental changes that humans produced were first of all not intended changes. Nobody who started to cultivate plants in the Neolithic could anticipate that this would result in a domestication going so far that some of the species actually then eventually depended on human intervention for their own survival. This sometimes must have taken hundreds, if not thousands of years. So it's clearly an unintended consequence of human behavior. Yet in the process of domestication, human societies must have changed their own behavior. It's not just the plants that adapted to the cultural niche created by the humans, but humans themselves must have changed their social and their cognitive behavior in order to maintain this niche, even before knowing that this would eventually lead to domestication, and to appropriate the natural resources in such a way that they became increasingly independent of the specific context in which these events first occurred. Now, we will discuss this in much more detail, I hope, in the seminar. Let me just point to the fact that this really throws a new light on the history of the Neolithic Revolution and some of the subsequent threshold. First of all, the Neolithic Revolution was not a one-time geographical event. There have been many, and probably also many, aborted attempts at domestication throughout the world. And probably we can understand the sustainability to this day of these events only by considering also the connections between those events. So very early on, human changed their environment not just in a local way, but also in a connected, in a global way, because people exchanged what they planted and what they harvested, and thus separated the biological populations from their natural habitat, thus enhancing the process. So you can see, if you go to the details, human behavior, human concepts about what they were doing played a large role in this cultural process. It was not a blind selective event. It was the change of the regulative structures of human societies. And what we hope is that understanding such processes in greater detail will also help us to understand some of the major phases and some of the dynamics leading up to the Anthropocene.
So to conclude briefly here and to wake you up, if we follow that logic of the Neolithic Revolution and domestication as a case of that interplay between complex regulatory structures, selective regimes, and niche construction, as Jürgen just indicated, it was actually dependent on the existence of a social niche of small populations of humans trading with each other, including then trading the seeds of those early plants in order to allow for effective domestication in similar ecological areas, but where the populations were not native, because otherwise you constantly get the genetic backflow in form of outbreeding. So that's one case. Now let's jump to one of the points that that Bernd had on his slide yesterday when we got started with all the indicators of the Anthropocene. And one of the indicators, of course, was species or biodiversity loss as a major problem of the Anthropocene. Let's be provocative. This, first of all, it's not quite true. It's only loss in some small parts of the biodiversity, but never mind that. The loss we are arguing is loss of naturally evolved species. Yet at the very same time, we are now in the process of generating synthetic biodiversity at an increasingly high rate. So what does that tell us about the total biodiversity moving forward? And what I'm talking about here is, of course, not only microbial diversity. We are generating new forms of microbes, so biological engineering, but it goes beyond that too. Some of it sounds science fiction. Some of it is already reality. It's more reality than most of you probably know or want to know. But what does that mean in terms of looking forward to the Anthropocene? And what does that mean about the interesting dynamics between what's now called the technosphere? And since Peter Huff is not here, we were not really talking about him, but it really is a component about the technosphere, the kind of reality of technological objects and systems that are put forward and that become an increasingly intertwined part of our now expanded niche that includes not just ecological parameters, but also technological parameters. So this is something to think about. So in short, what we try to do in our seminar is basically a couple of very simple take-home lessons. First of all, history matters. Secondly, complexity matters. If you combine history with complexity, you get complex coevolutionary dynamics. We have to figure out what some of the effects of that dynamics, including effects on canalization and the suppression of innovation. And that certainly gives us some perspective about what might be possible futures. And that's basically the subject of that seminar. Thanks.